I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, a protester is killed as Bahrain marks its uprising anniversary. Syrians displaced by war struggle to survive. The North Korean nuclear test focuses the spotlight on Iran. And what can Obama do to improve his image in the Middle East and North Africa?
Three key things would have to be addressed, all three of which, almost being unsympathetic, the president can do very little or nothing about.
It's all ahead. A teenage boy has died in clashes between protesters and security forces in Bahrain as the Gulf Kingdom marks 2 years of civil unrest. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Dubai.
Witnesses say 16-year-old Hussein Al-Jaziri was fatally wounded by shotgun fire in the village of Dahi on Thursday morning. He was one of hundreds of protesters who took to the streets at dawn on the second anniversary of the Shiite-led uprising against the nation's Sunni-dominated government. Authorities have promised a full investigation into the teenager's death. Anwar Abdurrahman is the editor-in-chief of the pro-government newspaper Akbar Al-Khalij.
It's so sad that we have lost a citizen. But believe me, police is not there to kill anybody. Police is there only to control the law and order.
Altercations between protesters and security forces have become commonplace in Bahrain, which is home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. According to the International Federation for Human Rights, at least 80 people have been killed in what's become the longest-running uprising of the so-called Arab Spring. Bahrain's Shiite majority accuse their Sunni rulers of discrimination and have been pushing for more rights and a greater political voice in the country. But slow reform and political deadlock have led some government opponents to resort to more violent tactics and demand the ouster of the monarchy. In an effort to resolve the impasse, opposition groups this week took part in government-sponsored reconciliation talks, which will continue indefinitely. Hardline Shiite groups oppose the dialogue as it's not aimed at removing the monarchy. But Salman Al-Jalama from Bahrain's Information Affairs Authority says the dialogue is a significant step forward.
We are very optimistic, and so far the initial response has been very positive, so we are excited.
Opposition groups, however, have voiced frustration at the government's refusal to enter the discussions directly. And on the anniversary of Bahrain's uprising, Jalal Fairuz from the opposition Al-Wafaq party says few people in the country believe the dialogue will result in positive change.
In general, we can see, unfortunately, that the people are not optimistic. They are rather dismayed and disappointed much more than last year. That's why this year we have much more people in the streets.
Al-Wafaq has called for a major rally outside the capital, Manama, on Friday, the traditional day of protesting in Bahrain. The underground February 14th Revolution Youth Coalition has also urged sympathizers to march to the original center of the protest movement, the former Pearl Roundabout, which has since been turned into a restricted military zone. Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
New U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States has to change what he calls Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's calculation about his situation. Mr. Kerry, speaking alongside Jordan's foreign minister, said Mr. Assad has not yet realized that it is inevitable he will be thrown out of power.
The preference of the administration is to make sure we have a political solution, if at all possible. That is the preferable outcome here, that there be a negotiated solution, but that it would result in President Assad's departure. The president, I think, believes, I believe, that that is going to happen. I'm not going to get into time frames, but I am convinced that the current track on the ground is going to result at some point in time, that there is an inevitability here. Now, that hasn't sunk into him yet, obviously. There is some need to address the question of his calculation about where things are. When we finalize the components of my trip, and you're aware of what I'm doing, I think one of my purposes will be to try to see what can be done with respect to that calculation and how we might be able to affect it. That said, the reasons for wanting to have a negotiated solution, which the Syrian opposition council leader Khatib has himself courageously spoken out about in the last days, is that you want to avoid, if you can, I emphasize, the implosion of the state, because that's dangerous for everybody. And it proposes the possibility of the worst kinds of outcomes. So we need to keep this possibility of a negotiated solution in mind. I still remain hopeful that there may be an equation where the Russians and the United States could in fact find more common ground than we have found yet with respect to that.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Jordanian Foreign Minister Nasser Judeh said he did not want to put a timeline for President Assad's ouster and again called for talks and a political transition. Relief agencies say the fighting in Syria is displacing a growing number of people. Nearly 700,000 are refugees in neighboring countries, and an estimated 2 million are displaced inside Syria, where conditions are harsh and despair is deep. VOA Scott Bob reports from the Bab al-Salama camp in northern Syria.
A winter day in the Bab al-Salama camp. More than 10,000 Syrians displaced by war are struggling to survive in this tent city. Its population has doubled in the past 3 months, primarily because of bombings by Syrian government forces. Most of these people are waiting for a safer place in neighboring Turkey, which already shelters nearly 200,000 Syrian refugees. Every few days, the Turkish authorities allow a few hundred in. Ahmed, her assumed name, fled the town of Azaz 1 month ago with her 9 children. She says life here is hard.
It's starvation. There is no bread. The relief that comes doesn't reach us. There is no medical assistance, no sanitation, nothing.
A Turkish aid group provides meals, but residents say these are not enough. Many people are malnourished. Water and sanitation are lacking. Some medicines are in short supply. At night, the temperature drops to near freezing. Some people have heating stoves, but many do not. There is no firewood, so residents burn trash to stay warm. The smoke creates a health hazard. Mohammed Rami is a merchant who fled Aleppo 4 months ago. He's paid $7 a day to help dig drainage ditches.
It's to remove the rainwater. Before, it was like a lake here, but the mud is also a big problem.
Ahmad Hatib lived here for 7 months before deciding to put up a tent for his family of 10. He thinks the war between forces of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and rebels of the Free Syrian Army will be long, and the killing will continue.
As soon as Bashar al-Assad falls, everyone will go back home. But until then, nobody is going anywhere.
The UN says the 2-year conflict has killed nearly 70,000 people. As long as war rages, more and more Syrians will flee and end up in places like this. Scott Bob, VOA News, Bab al-Salama Camp, northern Syria.
The United Nations nuclear watchdog has returned from Iran with no new agreement on investigating allegations that the country is working to develop nuclear weapons. Herman Nackertz led the International Atomic Energy Agency team in the latest round of talks Wednesday in Tehran. But he said today the two sides were unable to finalize a deal.
We had discussions on the structured approach document, but could not finalize the document. As you know, that document, once agreed, should facilitate the resolution of the outstanding issues regarding possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program.
He said the commitment to continue dialogue is unwavering.
We will work hard now to try and resolve the remaining differences, but time is needed to reflect on the way forward.
Iran says it has agreed with UN inspectors on some points over its nuclear program. Iran's state-run news agency says some differences were resolved while new proposals would be brought up at the next meeting of the so-called P5 plus one countries. They are the 5 permanent UN Security Council members, the United States, Britain, China, France, and Russia, plus Germany. In New York Wednesday, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton told the UN Security Council she is hopeful some progress can be made in talks planned for February 26th with Iran at a venue in Kazakhstan.
We hope Iran will come to this negotiation with flexibility and that we can make substantial progress. Our strength and credibility in negotiating with Iran derives from the E3 plus 3, but also from the more general support that we receive from the international community. I am very grateful for the constant support of the UN Security Council. And I would add that our cooperation with and support to the International Atomic Energy Agency is also very important. We remain determined to work towards a solution of the Iranian nuclear issue based on the dual-track approach. There is no doubt that the pressure of sanctions has been instrumental in bringing Iran back to the negotiating table. But sanctions cannot be an end in themselves. The key is for Iran to comply fully with its international obligations.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton. Iran's nuclear ambitions are also being scrutinized in light of this week's North Korean nuclear test. VOA's Jeff Selden has this report for VOA Television.
Celebrations in North Korea, where the country's latest nuclear test is being publicly celebrated. But as worldwide condemnation pours in, there's also the recognition the test goes beyond the saber-rattling of Pyongyang. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
This is about proliferation. And this is also about Iran, because they're linked.
Experts say tough talk alone is unlikely to resonate in Iran. So what Tehran does next may very well depend on how the world backs up similar talk to North Korea.
If you want to prevent Iran from getting the bomb, you have to take a hard line against North Korea.
Former U.S. National Security Council member Raymond Tanter says so far, Western resolve has not been strong enough.
If you allow North Korea to get away with militarizing, with three nuclear tests, with any number of missile tests, that signals to Iran that a nuclear-armed North Korea can get away with murder. But, and therefore, Iran will not be deterred from getting the bomb.
There are indications Iran and North Korea are helping each other, having signed a deal late last year to cooperate on a variety of scientific endeavors.
That type of collaboration has been a concern in Washington for years, and some analysts now warn it's clear. Iran sharing its expertise on uranium enrichment in exchange for Pyongyang's superior missile technology.
That strategy of cooperation is not without wide-ranging risks. Brookings Institution scholar Michael O'Hanlon.
In regard to Iran, what we're seeing is the military facilities can be, or the nuclear facilities can be identified. They can be theoretically attacked with a limited operation.
Iran has repeatedly denied its nuclear program is for anything other than civilian purposes. At his State of the Union address, U.S. President Barack Obama warned Tehran will only be allowed to push so far.
We will do what is necessary to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon.
How that will be done may depend on the outcome of talks between world powers and Iran, expected later this month. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Wednesday on our program, our Middle East Bureau Chief Elizabeth Arrett was telling us about the drop in support for the Obama administration in parts of the Middle East and North Africa. Robert Powell is a senior Middle East analyst with the Economist Intelligence Unit in New York, and we asked him what the president needs to do to improve his image in the region.
Well, it's hardly a new phenomenon that President Obama's lofty rhetoric has been dashed by reality, so I think it's no great shock that people in the Middle East have been somewhat disappointed, just like some arguably have within the United States. But if he's going to rectify the situation, and certainly the U.S.'s standing now is pretty close to what it was when George W. Bush was at the top, then you'd imagine three key things would have to be addressed, all three of which, if one was being unsympathetic, the president can do very little or nothing about. First of all, and it's a long-held cliché, the Israel issue is a burning sore within the region, and the U.S. has really done very little to distance itself from Israel, even though on the personal level, President Barack Obama has a difficult relationship, to put it generously, with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Overall, there has been virtually no movement in pushing Israel on some of the key issues that the Palestinians and others have complained about over decades, notably settlements and the like. So a more forceful approach to Israel would at least attract attention within the region that the U.S. is maybe aligning itself more with their arguments. But U.S. politics is as it is, and you can't expect a massive shift. Although these might be a surprise, of course. Obama is visiting Israel soon. And then there's the other areas. I mean, perhaps if the U.S. was to flood some of these countries with cash, Egypt might be one. It's been struggling terribly economically since its own Arab Spring and the fall of Mubarak, and its economy basically stagnated. The money, though, that's been provided, particularly to the central bank, to the Egyptian government, well, the vast majority has come from Saudi Arabia and others. The U.S. simply doesn't have much money. There's not much to go around. I mean, we have our own fiscal difficulties within the United States and certainly cannot prop up other countries in the Middle East with a few billion dollars. And then thirdly, the old charge has been around for a long time about U.S. hypocrisy. The U.S. talks a good game, as indeed does President Obama, about supporting freedom within the region, about backing Democrats. But in reality, when push comes to shove, it will often align with old regimes. And when you do see the United States selling $60 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia, when you see the U.S. offering nothing more than, say, concern when Bahrain cracks down on peace activists, when it jails opposition leaders, when it bans demonstrations, then that charge of hypocrisy is really alive and well. And as much as we've seen a more sophisticated, say, foreign policy under President Obama in dealing with the changing realities within the region, the charge remains, and it still remains a reality, unfortunately. So those kind of three areas really would need to be addressed. First, Israel. Second, cash. And third, hypocrisy, if President Obama was to turn around the United States' reputation in the Middle East.
One place where it seems like the Obama administration's hands are a bit tied is in Egypt. And he doesn't want to interfere with the infant government that is being formed there. But on the other hand, the protesters feel that they need his support. What can you do there?
Yeah, this was something that President Obama touched on in his State of the Union address. That actually is a very, very difficult line to tread. You don't want to be seen to be overtly interfering in another country's wishes. But on the other hand, you want to ensure that those who are at least aligned with your sensibilities are in charge. It's at times, of course, an impossible line to tread. Clearly, with Egypt, the U.S. doesn't have a huge amount of influence. Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, has become increasingly authoritarian, and having initially tried to distance himself from party politics, has in fact come down firmly on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood, where he hails originally. Probably if there's one piece of advice, it would at least be to get involved at all. It was noticeable that after Mohamed Morsi won the election, it was a close election, became the leader of Egypt, he met China's president, he met the Iranian president, but he never met the United States president. And you can't really have an influence if you're not going to meet the people who are in charge. So a more proactive effort to meet the new leaders, to meet those shaping the situation on the ground, would at least give the U.S. a chance to shape the policy environment and perhaps improve its image within the region.
Meanwhile, in Syria, the opposition is really frustrated in its fight against the government. But the Obama administration says no to giving the rebels arms, directly arming them. Should that policy change, or should we just stay where we are concerning Syria?
Well, in this case, I think a lot of people would have sympathy with the U.S.'s position. The rebels themselves, even though they did form something called the Syrian National Coalition, they coalesced, if you will, theoretically in a single group. In reality, on the ground, it's a very fragmented story with all kinds of different groups, with local leaders barely coordinating. So when you provide weapons to one side, you really have no idea of whose hands they will end up. There are now an increasing number of Salafi, these sort of puritanical Islamic fighters, who are increasingly taking the lead in the war in Syria. In fact, they recently took a very large airbase near Aleppo. And the U.S. would be concerned about weapons that are going in ending up in these people's hands. Of course, there are some are very instructive lessons from recent history in Afghanistan, where the U.S. supplied weapons to the Mujahideen, and then, of course, not long after, they turned against the United States itself. So it was very careful to avoid history repeating itself there. So directly arming the rebels, even though they have a great need for arms and that their calls for greater support are well-placed and, in fact, are ever urgent for the United States, actually realizing that, actually meeting these requests, is fraught with danger. And probably the U.S. will have to retain a backseat role, even though it means, in that case, diluting its influence.
Robert Powell, a senior Middle East analyst with the Economist Intelligence Unit in New York. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.